Good morning, everyone. Bonjour et bienvenue à tous. Welcome to the Big Thinking Lecture hosted by the Canadian Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences. My name is Graham Carr. I'm the incoming president of the Federation, and it's certainly great to be here today and to see so many people out for our inaugural event of the year. I'd particularly like to extend a warm welcome to members of Parliament and senators who have joined us here today. If you can just identify yourselves, Sean Murphy, Patricia Davidson, Wayne Easter, I didn't see, Charlie Angus, Mike Savage, and did I miss anyone? No? All right. Well, thank you all for coming, though. The goal of the Big Thinking Lecture series is to bring research closer to those who can use it. Policymakers and legislators need current and relevant research to inform their work and help them formulate sound policy. La recherche en sciences humaines et sociales s'attaque aux grandes questions de notre temps, et les chercheurs à travers le pays sont à l'œuvre afin d'éclairer les discussions et améliorer la vie des Canadiens et Canadiennes. We are very pleased to have an outstanding example of social science research and social science and humanities research in Canada today with us this morning. A prominent figure in the field of communication technologies, Catherine Middleton, is professor at the Ted Rogers School of Information Technology Management at Ryerson University, where she teaches in the MBA program. Dr. Middleton holds the Canada Research Chair in Communication Technologies in the Information Society. Her research focuses on consumer adoption of new communication technologies with a focus on mobile devices, fixed and wireless broadband networks. She's also interested in how Canadians use or don't use the internet in their daily lives. Dr. Middleton's going to speak for about 20 to 25 minutes, followed by questions and discussion, and we'll try and have everything wrapped up before 9 o'clock. So please join me in welcoming Catherine Middleton.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to begin by thanking the Federation for the opportunity to give this talk, as well as the Canada Research Chairs Program, SHRC, and Infrastructure Canada for supporting the research that I will talk about this morning. Let me begin with a story. 10 days before the recent Australian federal election, opposition leader Tony Abbott was interviewed on a current affairs show and asked about the opposition's plan to improve broadband access for Australians. This plan, released the day of the interview, was quite different to the government's plan, and the reporter asked Abbott for some details. It quickly became evident that Abbott was unable to answer these questions, repeating several times that he wasn't a tech head. After continuing to press Abbott for details, without success, the reporter then concluded, and I quote, "Because you're not a tech head, you can't explain your policy to us. How you will use towers, how much fiber you would need, what spectrum you would use when we're told there is none to actually deliver your wireless technology," end quote. These may sound like tech head details, and they are. But as the rest of this story shows, in this digital era, politicians ignore technology at their peril. Some of you know how this story ends. After the votes were counted, neither side had a clear majority, and negotiations to form a coalition began. More than 2 weeks passed while three independent MPs, all from rural Australia, consulted with their constituents as to which party to support. Finally, two of the three announced their decision to side with the Labour Party, allowing it to remain in power. These decisions were complex and, of course, involved many factors, but broadband was a central one. As MP Tony Windsor said in announcing his decision to support the government, "You do it once, you do it right, and you do it with fiber." That has been one of the major influences that I have had in terms of making a decision, end quote. The it he was referring to was extending broadband connectivity to his constituents, and he chose to support the party with an ambitious broadband development plan already underway. I will return to Australia's broadband plan later in this talk, but first, I hope I have convinced you that politicians and policymakers need to understand today's technologies and their impacts in shaping digital societies. Broadband networks are often described as the utility of the 21st century, as important as water and electricity. Broadband connectivity can, and I emphasize the word can, foster social and economic development in three main areas. First, broadband connectivity enables individual citizens to access an enormous range of service and content. Second, it allows service delivery to communities. And third, it supports and enables other infrastructures that are essential to our economy. For instance, transportation systems or energy management, including smart grids. I will focus today on broadband use by individual citizens. I have deliberately chosen the word citizen here, not consumer, as the benefits of broadband should not be restricted to the commercial arena. Canada was a leader in encouraging its citizens to use the internet and broadband technologies. In 1997, Canada was the only country in the OECD with a measurable uptake of broadband connectivity by its citizens. Canadians had the highest broadband uptake in the OECD until the year 2000. As of December 2009, Canada ranked 9th in the OECD in broadband uptake with 30.5 subscriptions per 100 inhabitants, up marginally from the 10th place we had occupied for the past couple of years. The OECD data can be somewhat confusing, as it measures broadband uptake in terms of subscribers per 100 inhabitants. But the data is widely cited and often used by governments to justify investment in broadband infrastructure or to highlight increases in broadband uptake within a country. Both the CRTC and Statistics Canada report broadband uptake rates in terms of percentage of households with broadband connections, a figure that is much easier to make sense of. The most recent statistic comes from the CRTC's 2010 Communication Monitoring Report. To this point, however, I haven't provided a definition of broadband. What we might call first-generation broadband can be thought of as internet connectivity that is faster than dial-up service. As anyone who has used dial-up can attest, being faster than dial-up is not really a terribly high hurdle to clear. The CRTC reports that 72% of Canadian households did have faster-than-dial-up connections in 2009, but just over 60% were subscribing to broadband services at speeds of greater than 1.5 megabits per second. This is the speed that the federal government has defined as being the minimum speed for broadband connections, and the projects it funds must offer at least this speed of connection. I will discuss next-generation broadband speeds in more detail in a few minutes, but want to note here that 1.5 megabits per second is really not very fast. In some Canadian cities, internet service providers have been offering speeds of up to 50 megabits per second for some time, and more recently you can get a connection of up to 120 megabits per second, potentially 80 times faster than the minimum speed. Remember that broadband connectivity is thought to be central to encouraging the development of a digital society. My view of a digital society is one in which all Canadians have the necessary skills and technology to use our broadband connections to access information, to engage with each other in debate and discussion, to access government, business, and community services, and to connect with anyone, anywhere, for whatever purposes we desire. Canadians will engage in a digital society if it offers benefits to them, and if they have the resources and capacity to do so. It is up to policymakers to ensure that our digital society is accessible by all and that no one is excluded. There is still a digital divide in Canada. That is a gap between those who are already engaging in our digital society in some way and those who are not. Among those who are not engaged are older Canadians, those in lower income brackets, and those with less formal education or low literacy levels. These basic demographic characteristics are well understood and need to be addressed by policymakers if all Canadians are to experience the benefits of a digital society. There are very real problems getting access to broadband connectivity in rural and remote areas. On this point, some of you will remember the outcry in March of this year when funding was cut to the Community Access Program, a program that provides much-needed connectivity in underserved sites across the country. Fortunately, funding has been restored, at least temporarily. Approximately 95% of Canadian households are served by at least one broadband provider. As noted, though, fewer than two-thirds of Canadian households actually have a broadband subscription, meaning that many households that could get broadband connection choose not to do so. Statistics Canada's Canadian Internet Use Survey offers some insights on this point. It notes that 80% of adult Canadians have used the Internet for personal purposes in the past year. Of the non-users, 37% say that they have no interest in the Internet, and only 7% note cost as a reason for not being online. There is certainly a challenge in encouraging non-users to join us online, and no one should be coerced to participate in a digital society. A real concern, however, is that by not participating in a digital society, individuals may become disenfranchised. Think of the migration of government information, of services and forms onto the Internet. What are your departments, your constituency offices doing to ensure that this information remains accessible to all Canadians, even those who are uncertain about going online or unable to do so? I'm guessing that there are people in this audience who have at least three devices with them right now that they could use to access the Internet. I'm one of them. But I'm guessing that there are also people in this audience who are like Australian opposition leader Tony Abbott, not tech heads. Some of you act as the tech support person for your extended family and circle of friends. Others call on children or younger colleagues for assistance in figuring out things like how to get music onto an MP3 player, how to find that photo that someone posted on Facebook, or how to check whether someone is talking about you on Twitter. We don't have good measures of what it takes for individuals to be truly at ease in a digital society. My research has been exploring this issue, trying to figure out how engaged Canadians really are with the Internet as a way of understanding our progress towards a digital society. Let me share some of the findings. We know that 80% of Canadians have used the Internet in the past year. This is certainly a good indicator that many Canadians have embraced the online environment. 96% of these Canadians use the Internet from home, and of these, about three-quarters use the Internet daily. To keep the math simple, I will present data in terms of the overall Canadian population. Doing this, we find that about 60% of all adult Canadians go online daily, meaning, of course, that 40% of adult Canadians don't go online every day. This is quite a large number, and one that should be kept in mind when developing online services. Additionally, only 42% of adult Canadians spend 5 or more hours online per week. This data is from a year ago, and the StatsCan survey that is underway now will likely show an increase in this number. But it does suggest that although Canadians are using the Internet, not everyone is a heavy user. Looking at what Canadians do online, we find that more than 70% of adult Canadians have used email from home in the past year. This is the most popular online activity. About 60% of Canadians use the Internet for general browsing, for fun or leisure. More than half of us have paid a bill online or done some banking in the past year. About a quarter of us watched some TV or downloaded movies online. But only 20% reported that they'd used the Internet to communicate with government, the same number that reported contributing content, for instance, uploading photos or writing a blog. What can we conclude from this information? Are Canadians well prepared to engage with each other online, to conduct business transactions, and to access government services? The answer, unfortunately, is that we don't really know. What I believe the StatsCan data suggests, though, is that while Canadians are enthusiastic Internet users, many of us are not yet particularly sophisticated in what we do online. There are, of course, demographic differences in our Internet usage patterns. I won't go into these other than to say that younger users spend more time and do more things online. Some of our observers note that we don't really have to worry about the fact that many Canadians don't use the Internet extensively. The argument goes, well, those Canadians are old, and they'll die soon, and the problem will go away. I've heard this several times. The next generation will know how to do everything online. They'll just cruise into the digital society, and we'll be fine. As someone who is not a member of the next generation, let me remind everyone that it will be a long time before we all die off. And by the time we do, today's next generation will be the older members of the digital society facing tomorrow's equivalent of trying to figure out exactly how Facebook works or how to connect the computer to the TV to watch movies, while their digitally savvy kids look on in dismay. Coming back to the question of a digital society for Canadians, there is much to be done before we will all be comfortable in an online environment. There is no point in encouraging citizens to go online simply because it satisfies a policy goal of expanding broadband uptake. Instead, citizens should be motivated to join the digital society because of real benefits that it can offer, improving their quality of life, making it easier, more effective, or simply better to engage with government, business, and other citizens. Digital society and the development and usage of broadband networks are tightly linked. Broadband is the enabler of digital societies, but networks alone are not enough. In order for citizens and countries to truly benefit from investment in broadband infrastructure, attention must be paid to the development of services that take advantage of this broadband connectivity. Public sector investment in broadband networks is frequently justified by statements about the benefits that can accrue from wide-scale adoption of e-health, e-learning, e-commerce, and e-government services. This is likely the case, but to date, here in Canada and elsewhere around the world, very few of these applications are actually in use. There is a big gap between the rhetoric of the benefits of broadband connectivity and the availability of applications that would actually enable ordinary citizens to fully engage in the digital society in ways that have a meaningful impact. Discussions of broadband-enabled digital societies assume that high-quality, affordable broadband connectivity is available to all. In 2001, Canada's National Broadband Task Force concluded that Canada must seize the opportunities presented by the broadband revolution, and all Canadians should reap the benefit of high-speed internet access, end quote. The task force, which as some of you may remember was chaired by our new Governor General, David Johnston, noticed that broadband speed should be sufficient to support real-time video interaction and recommended that a minimum speed of 1.5 megabits per second, symmetrical, would be required. Almost 10 years later, the same minimum speed is being applied to define broadband connectivity in Canada, and the recommendation for symmetrical speed, that is equal capacity to upload information as well as download it, is no longer in place. The rest of the world has not stood still. In Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore, and assorted other locations, including Chattanooga, Tennessee, gigabit broadband connectivity is available, offering network speeds more than 600 times faster than our current broadband standard. Broadband networks being built in Australia and Korea will offer gigabit capacity in the next couple of years. The U.S. has a slightly less ambitious target, aiming to connect at least 100 million American homes to 100 megabit per second services over the next 10 years. While there are fewer applications that can take advantage of these speeds right now and very limited demand for the service, gigabit connectivity signals the future direction of digital societies. Gigabit connectivity is bold and ambitious, and significant network innovation and investment is needed to make it happen. There are certainly serious debates as to whether this sort of network capacity and speed are really needed, and these debates shouldn't be ignored. Believers in what is called big broadband, broadband that can have a transformative impact, argue that this is the way of the future. A 2009 OECD report estimated that investment in this sort of broadband connectivity, delivered using fiber to the home, could pay for itself in 10 years. This conclusion was based on achieving savings in the electricity, health, transportation, and education sectors, and as a result of using the broadband network for service provision. So the challenge facing Canada and other countries is how to transition from first-generation broadband connectivity to the next-generation broadband that will enable social and economic benefits. There are lessons to be learned from other countries, but each country is unique, and plans are not entirely replicable. What is common to many broadband plans, however, is a vision of a national broadband network, or networks, accessible to all service providers and offering a common platform for innovation and service delivery. The Alberta SuperNet is a working model of this approach. Although it does not provide connectivity directly to citizens in their homes, the SuperNet connects thousands of government offices and provides services to 429 communities in Alberta. Any agency or service provider can contract with the network operator to provide services to anyone on the network for a uniform price across the province. In Singapore, the government has invested in a public-private partnership that brings gigabit broadband to all premises in the country. As with the Alberta SuperNet, any service provider can use this network to reach any premise. Singapore is a very small country, but a similar approach is also underway in Australia, a country far more comparable to Canada in terms of geography and population density. The Australian National Broadband Network, initiated by the Kevin Rudd Labor government and continued by Julia Gillard's recently elected government, will build a single wired broadband network to serve 93% of premises in the country. The remaining 7% of premises will have access to wireless or satellite broadband. These networks are still works in progress, and there are many challenges inherent in building them. What we do see internationally, though, is a strong commitment to building broadband infrastructure that will meet the needs of citizens, offering affordable, high-quality network access that can be used by all. Governments, businesses, and communities are becoming engaged in developing applications and services that really will make a difference for citizens, realizing the promise of a digital society. There is much work to be done in Canada. We do have high broadband adoption rates, but usage data suggests that the internet is not yet central to the daily lives of many Canadians. However, any efforts to encourage more extensive uptake of broadband networks must be built on an understanding of real benefits that broadband can provide. There are many successful programs that help individuals gain confidence in the use of computers and broadband networks, and these should be continued. We must also continue to measure our broadband usage and the impacts of broadband use with stable funding provided to Statistics Canada for the Canadian Internet Use Survey. Efforts must be made to develop applications that do make good use of broadband connectivity. The objective is not to develop applications to justify broadband deployment, but to take advantage of the convenience, speed, and communications possibilities offered by broadband to provide better services to citizens. Innovation should be fostered across society, with all interested parties encouraged to develop new broadband applications and services to meet the needs of Canadians. A bold vision is required to enable the transition from first-generation to next-generation broadband networks. It is unlikely that a single national broadband network will be proposed for Canada, so the challenge for the federal government, the provinces, the CRTC, and service providers is to develop models that will result in affordable, high-quality, next-generation broadband services that are accessible to all. These models must be developed in consultation with the network's users, us, the citizens of Canada. To realize a broadband-enabled digital society in Canada, we need engaged, informed, and digitally literate citizens. Useful applications and services that offer real value, providing services in more innovative, more convenient, more affordable, and more accessible ways, and a world-class broadband network infrastructure that connects all Canadians and allows any interested party to provide service to any other. Achieving these outcomes requires vision, commitment, and planning. The potential benefits of a broadband-enabled digital society are enormous, and it is up to us to ensure that Canadians have what is needed for all of us to become digital citizens. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Catherine. That was great. I'm sure there are going to be lots of questions, and I'm going to give you a few moments to formulate those questions because I'd like to ask Mike Savage, the MP for Dartmouth Coal Harbour, who has helped sponsor this event and allow us to enjoy the venue this morning, to say a few words of thank you.
Mike. Well, thank you very much, and I want to thank you for accommodating the schedule a bit. The new committee schedule on Parliament Hill means we now start at 8:45 instead of 9, and in my case, our committee is meeting off the Hill. So I appreciate the opportunity to thank Dr. Middleton and also to thank the Federation and SHRC, their partners, for the great work that they do in putting on these big thinking breakfasts. In the last few months, probably in the spring, I guess, and today, we've really covered about everything there is in Canada. The last few topics have been money, marriage, and technology. I don't know what's been left out. But the challenging thoughts we have today are something that as politicians, so people like Sean and Charlie and myself, need to take up that challenge and follow it up. We need more money in research in Canada. We can never have too much, but I particularly think we need more in the social sciences and the humanities. That's a message I brought before to these breakfasts. Our scientists can study our heart. Our social scientists look into the soul of Canada. And I encourage all MPs when they're away and senators to visit their social scientists. I often say, go and hug your local social scientist and humanist within the bounds of common decency and the relationship that you have. I'll be visiting next week. I'm going to be in St. John's, and I hope to see Noreen Golfman while I'm there and have a chat and see what's happening at Memorial. But I want to thank you very much. This is very important. Yeah, it was well presented. We really very much appreciate you taking the time to come and share your big thinking with us on the Hill. Thank you, Dr. Middleton. I think we have a gift of some kind. Does somebody have a gift? If not, I'm going to give you my notes. And oh, yes. Looks like a rather large CD.
You can throw the notes in the bonus.
That's great. Thank you.
So if you have questions, there's a microphone strategically positioned at the front of the room. Si vous préférez de poser des questions en français ou en anglais, c'est à vous à décider. Maybe I'll just start off. Catherine, you mentioned that I think it was 20% of Canadians had used the internet for interactions with government. And I suppose we could speculate about the reasons why that figure is so low or seems so low. And rather than me speculating about that, would you care to offer some thoughts on that?
Sure. I think the reason that anybody uses a service is because it provides value to them. So I think what that number tells us is that the services that people are looking for simply aren't there. Given that we've got 70% of people using email, we've got people online every day. We don't engage with government every day, but we engage with government pretty frequently. And I think if there were more services online, more services available, that people would indeed use them. So I don't think it's a reluctance to use the services. There may be a small element of that. There's certainly, in some services, there's certainly trust issues. So if you're doing some sort of transaction issue, that might be a question to consider. But I think it's primarily a question of availability, and that's a challenge really to all of us to articulate what we're looking for and then to have those services developed and available.
Thank you. Okay, if you can maybe identify yourself before you pose your question.
Hello, my name is Katrina Mersch, and I'm a public servant, but I'm also a local blogger. And I just wanted to comment on your comment that the web generation of today will be kind of the Luddites of tomorrow. And I found that I'm a little bit skeptical because I think one of the things about the web generation is we kind of expect things to change. I mean, I grew up with a messaging service, ICQ, which then switched to MSN Messenger, which then switched to Google Chat. We had MySpace and we had Facebook. Now we're a bit older. We had LinkedIn. I mean, there are commonalities between these, but there are also a learning curve for each one. So I think what separates the web generation from maybe the older generation is not so much that we grew up with this. It's just we have the expectation that all of this is going to change all the time. So I was just wondering, is learning part of your definition of web literacy?
Yes, very much so. And I agree that Everybody's web literacy will continue to improve. So people who are in the net generation today, younger people today, are not going to lose the skills that they have. But I think what happens to all of us as we get older is that we just get a little bit less interested in the technology. We have less time. We get busier. When you look at the internet use data, there's actually a drop-off in use, a little drop, as people get into their 40s and 50s because they're doing other things. So I think that what we'll see is that, yes, people in general will be more network literate, more informed than our predecessors were, but I think that we'll always see a divide between older users and younger users. I'd like to be proved wrong, and part of the research that we need to continue to do needs to look at these sorts of things.
Good morning. It was an excellent talk. I'm Charlie Angus, the digital affairs spokesperson for the New Democratic Party. What concerns me in where we're going and where we're not going in Canada is a sense right now that business will make it happen. There doesn't seem to be a large public will to move broadband connectivity. I represent a region larger than Great Britain with 80,000 people. And these are fundamental issues, as you say, about whether people are able to exercise their franchise as citizens. For example, we've talked with telecom providers that say dial-up is as good as it gets when there's the duty to serve these constituents, because anything above dial-up is not a business case. Many of my communities, isolated small towns, when people are laid off and they want retraining and they can't travel 300 kilometers to the college is attempting to offer in-home education, but at 1.5 megabits, they can't access the programs and people drop out. I mean, it's that simple. 5 megabits, it's possible. So, and then we think that we haven't gotten to 5 megabits in Canada if they're going to gigabyte capacity in the rest of the world. It shows how far we are starting to fall behind. I mean, this isn't about going online and playing blackjack. This is about whether or not you're going to get retrained and rejoin the workforce. And between 1.5 and 5 and 5 and 10 is the difference between success and failure. So I'm encouraged by your words, but I think the only way we're going to make this happen is with a major investment and a major commitment from government that we're going to set those benchmarks, that we're going to ensure that rural Canada isn't left behind as some kind of digital third world.
Yeah, I agree. I agree very much. The Australian example is interesting because the decision that they made was that they would build a national broadband network, and in doing that, they could take some of the they could cross subsidize. So what happens in many countries is that the profitable areas are served by business, but then the profit isn't used to cross subsidize the development of broadband connectivity, the extension of services to those areas for which there isn't a business case. That said, there are certainly alternative models. Some of you may be aware of the work that's been done by KNET. It's a group of Aboriginal communities in northwestern Ontario that have really successfully developed broadband connectivity by having very strong community champions, people who understood the technology and who made it happen for their region. But that isn't the case everywhere. And so we do need, as you say, Charlie, we need people who know the needs of the communities, and we need support, because in many instances the business simply won't come in and provide that service. So it can't just be reliant on the market forces to drive connectivity.
Hi, I'm Sally Rutherford. I'm the Executive Director of the Canadian Political Science Association, but I have long-term rural connections with the Canadian Federation of Agriculture. The broadband issue is, in many respects, a federal responsibility. But you did mention Alberta as having an initiative that actually involves that province, and you just mentioned some Aboriginal bands that have taken on an initiative of their own. How do you see the jurisdictional responsibilities breaking out?
There is a lot of cooperation between the federal and provincial governments, and some of the federal programs over the past few years have required matching funds, and often the province has helped with that. I think what the provinces can bring is a much better understanding of the specific needs of a region. And in some provinces, Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, there's been a real push, a real concerted effort to get broadband to the entire province. They'll tell you that the province has 100% coverage. Now, I haven't been there recently. I don't know what the experience in some of those more remote communities are. But there certainly are a number of provincial initiatives that have been effective. But again, we need more. We really need more from everybody at every level to move us into this next generation, moving us beyond the basic connectivity, which is important, but isn't enough to really realize all these benefits that broadband can potentially provide.
Hi, I'm Tim Lougheed. I'm a local science writer. There's an interesting disconnect that you've identified between failures of national policy or even regional policy and success stories at the local level, whether it's Chattanooga or Kemptville. To what extent do you think, because there's a technical reality here in terms of metropolitan networks that providers have to respect, and you can't get it into places like, you know, little towns in northern Ontario without a lot of expense and trouble. To what extent is a national policy, an archaic creation, and these initiatives have to be driven at the local level, and funding and resources and authority have to be given to local authorities?
Certainly, you see that there are differences by province. There are actually differences by municipality in terms of planning, in terms of approval. One of the things, a lot of the broadband in rural areas is provided by wireless connectivity, and to do that, you often have a line of sight wireless connection. So you need a tower, and you need to have somewhere to put that tower. And there's a huge amount of politics around towers. Municipalities often control the towers. So a national plan is not going to make the siting of those towers easier. But what you can do at a national level, I think, is set the vision, set the ambition, set an overall goal for what we want our society to look like, and then work individually at the provincial, at the local level to figure out how you make that happen. But there are certainly things that you can do from a regulatory perspective that would be done on a national basis. And this is what we're seeing. Actually, in Europe, you see pan-European regulation to try and drive some of this stuff. So I agree that there's very much a challenge at the local level, and that some aspects of national policy won't help things at a local level, but I really think it's important that we have a very clear vision of what we want our society to be able to do in terms of access to technologies, and I do think that needs to come from a national body.
Now, just a quick follow-up to that, because you're obviously a fan of what's going on in Australia. Have the Australians taken that into account? In terms of giving authority at the local level so they can get it into isolated rural areas.
And as an example of one of the things that's going on in Australia, in Tasmania, they're working with the local power company. The fiber, they're building fiber to the home in much of Tasmania, and the fiber is being strung on hydro poles. And so in that instance, they need to have the cooperation with the local agency. In other parts of the country, it will be done differently. And so they're not only working with the local agencies, they're also, and I didn't mention this is quite important, they have an agreement in principle that will probably be signed fairly soon with Telstra, who's the telecom incumbent in the country, to use their assets to build this network. And that will help in a lot of these areas, because Telstra has already got the rights of way and so on. You're welcome.
Just in terms of that local national issue, I mean, you mentioned good reasons for looking at Australia, but I'm wondering if we look south of the border at the United States, would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, in the United States, they've had some stimulus funding, which has been given out, and much of that funding has been given out to do what's called middle mile, which is like the Alberta SuperNet is, to provide connectivity into communities and to solve the problem that many rural areas have of not being able to get service, not being able to have affordable connections back to the main centers. So there are state initiatives also, interestingly, in the U.S. There are two different perspectives at the state level. One is that there should be no municipal, no state involvement in broadband. So there are states where there are laws that say we do not allow anybody other than the telephone and cable companies and so on to provide broadband services. There are other states that have gone in the opposite direction and said we believe it's really important to have municipal involvement to allow Chattanooga, I mentioned, and I mention it just because it's a small city and it's kind of interesting. It's a city where the electrical company has been involved in building out this broadband network to the citizens. So there are lots of different models.
Hi, Hi, my name is Jovita Cherry, and I work for the Department of Citizenship and Immigration. I'm intrigued by the links you've drawn between broadband, citizenship, engagement, and connection. And I take your point that there are questions of access to services, which are perfectly legitimate, but there's also the school of thinking that suggests that greater connectivity actually results in less engagement and less connection. And I wondered whether there are data to support this in the Canadian context in terms of civic engagement, and as an example, maybe something like higher voting rates in better connected communities or higher rates of belonging, if your research touches on that sort of thing at all.
It doesn't, but what I can tell you at a general level is that the studies, there were some studies done initially 10 years ago that said that people who were online a lot of time became quite socially isolated, but more recent work has suggested the opposite, that you use the internet to connect, to build on existing ties, but to strengthen those ties. And so I think some of the initial concerns about the technology being isolating have dissipated over time. It's certainly an area where there is ongoing research, but it's not something that I'm studying myself.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Simon Doyle from the Wire Report. I think you said the Australian broadband plan was served 93% by fiber.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if you think that's possible in Canada, because I know there would probably be a lot of telecom companies who would say that it's not possible and that we would have to use fixed wireless or mobile wireless to serve a lot of rural and remote areas in Canada.
Yeah, the original plan in Australia was to serve 90% of the premises, and then there was a report done. It was an implementation report. So it was effectively the consulting company was given the task of figuring out how to build the network as it was proposed, and they came back after studying really by looking at the technology available in the country, and they said we think we can do fiber to 93% rather than 90%. So to answer that question, in Canada, we'd need to do that kind of study. What they did, they actually went and looked at where the local exchanges were and how much fiber, how long it was, and so on. I would think that we're probably not that far off, because Australia, like Canada, has a dispersed population, but many of us in both countries live in cities. That number, those fiber connections, are primarily reaching the people in cities and in smaller rural areas. So I don't know without doing the research, but I think the bigger challenge is how do you actually make use of existing assets to develop that network and to build out the fiber rather than building it from scratch?
Version of a technology problem.
Yes.
Analog
technology.
Analog technology.
Hi, my name is François Lévesque. I work at the Institute on Governance, but I'm also a blogger like Katrina. And I'd like to go back to, actually, the first question that was asked about service delivery and about Canada doing an okay job. And I'd like to know internationally what countries you feel are doing a very good job service delivery online and why they're doing well.
Okay. It's hard to find really good examples. At a national level, what you often find is local examples. So there are certainly lots of examples of telehealth projects. What's interesting, though, with telehealth is that often the project is delivered to a community center or to a healthcare center. So the argument that you want to build high-speed networks to the home to provide health services hasn't always been borne out by what we've seen to date. And it makes sense that if you're doing something complicated like a health consultation, it actually makes sense to have that in an environment where you have technical support. So in Alberta, we see a lot of this, where people would go to a center in the community with their healthcare provider, and they might video conference. If they're in some remote area, they might video conference back into Lethbridge or to Calgary or Edmonton. So that's one example. We also see lots of good e-learning examples. And again, often they're delivered to a community center rather than to the home. On the delivery to the home side, one of the places that that is taking steps to deliver good services is Singapore. And so as part of their national network, in addition to building the network, they have a separate project that's providing startup funds to companies specifically to develop innovative services. So the network has literally been switched on in the last couple of months. And so what we're seeing now is that this network is available, and these potential service providers are starting to develop the applications. But to give you an analogy, without giving you a specific example, if you look at the iPad and the iPhone and Android devices as well, and you look at the development of applications for those devices, there are just an enormous array of things that provide real value to us. And we probably couldn't have predicted that many of these applications would be useful. The difference between broadband and those applications is that the broadband networks that are being talked about as the next generation aren't really very widely available yet. So I think to really see good services, I think we need to wait a little while until people have had time to play around with them and actually figure out what to do. And Tasmania and Australia, where they're piloting the network, is one of these places where they're going to put a lot of effort on trying to develop these services. So I can point to a couple of services, but at the moment, you're more likely to see services at a community level than at a local individual at home level.
Okay, one more quick question. You get the last question.
Oh, thank you very much. Do you see a relationship, looking at different countries, with the general availability of information on government websites having any connection to that, the availability then, or the opportunity to use services that are provided by government? For example, that there would be more health information or more general information on any given subject.
Absolutely. So it's a question of really driving more people online. So the more information you've got, the more value it offers. So to the extent that you can put information online, and we're seeing, I didn't mention this, but we're seeing a lot of open data initiatives. So in a lot of countries and in municipalities around the world, governments are making their data available. And so you could take something like a public transit schedule and make that available, and then somebody can create an iPhone application that uses that. So they can take that information, they can do what they want with it, and so that allows far more accessibility, and it doesn't to information, and it doesn't require the government itself to figure out how to make the information or how to develop the services in ways that are valuable to individuals. So absolutely, the more that we put online, the more that people are likely to go online to access it.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Catherine. And actually, I'm reminded the point that Charlie Angus raised about the importance of connectivity for training and retraining. And for those of us in the education sector, obviously, this is a critical issue in terms of e-learning and distance education as well. Catherine, I'd just like to thank you for a really terrific talk, which covered a lot of topics of interest to public policy folk and to Canadians generally. And we certainly look forward to reading more of your work and seeing more of you in the future. So thank you very, very much. And just before, avant de terminer, j'aimerais profiter de l'occasion pour remercier le Conseil de recherche en sciences humaines du Canada pour son appui à rendre l'événement ce matin possible. Please also stay tuned for more information coming virtually to you from the Federation about other upcoming topics in our Big Thinking lecture series. We look forward to seeing you again at our next event in November. And as well, I want to take this opportunity for those of you who are looking for some intellectual inspiration in late May to invite you all to come to the Congress, which we are hosting, which is this year being hosted jointly by the University of New Brunswick and St. Thomas University, what used to be the Congress of Learned Societies. And we hope that you'll join us there, where a number of other Big Thinking lectures will be offered up to delegates and to members of the public. So again, thank you all for coming this morning. I look forward to seeing you in November, and thank you again, Catherine.